Now, in coming back to this, I want to assure you that you're not just guinea pigs for them. These letters appear to be private, verse 2 of chapter 1, and they appear to be addressed simply to the pastor or the leader in an area or of a congregation. But it is a mistake to think that the pastoral epistles are private letters merely, sealed up to be read only by people like Timothy. They are letters that were publicly read in the congregation, and therefore they're openly available in the providence of God in the New Testament. This is because Christians equally need to know God's will for the local church and for the leadership of the local church. Indeed, if the voting in the House of Laity and Synod last week is anything to go by, reformation in the churches is much more likely to come from the pew than from the pulpit at the moment. And therefore, a well-taught congregation with well-taught representatives are the very people that we ought to be looking for at the moment. On my desk last week, there was a letter from a church in Kent sending to me the letter that they had sent to their own bishop in distress at many things that are going on today, also sending with it the bishop's reply, which was really exceptionally fatuous in this case. They had talked to him about all the differences and false teaching that is around, and he simply wrote back and said that differences like this are healthy. Now, I don't know quite why this church wrote to us, except that they're hoping that we in here, in our church council, will do something to help them. But I couldn't help thinking that the letter that they received from their bishop would have been answered very well by chapter 1 of 1 Timothy. The bishop replied that differences in the church are healthy. Well, look at verse 3 of chapter 1. As I urged you when I was going to Macedonia, remain at Ephesus that you may charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine. You see, so that if that congregation was studying 1 Timothy, they would have had the answer in their own hands. Of course, it depends what you mean by difference. There are always differences amongst Christians. What we can't have are differences about ultimate authority. If under the authority of the Scriptures, we have certain differences of emphasis, well and good. But if we differ as to what the authority is, if our differences mean that we're teaching something which is not the Christian faith, then all we can say is what Jesus said, a house divided against itself will fall. Any church in that position will ultimately disintegrate. That is certain. So, you see, these chapters we're looking at are not simply about leadership, though they include that. They tell us how to deal with the situation in very difficult days as Paul faced and the church faced at Ephesus. Now we turn to chapter 2 to see what this has to teach us and our leadership. Now the type of sermon that I'm going to give this morning is not, I think, one of the most attractive. I think most people prefer the preacher to have done all the weighing up and cooking in the kitchen and to put in front of their face, in front of their nose, front of their lips, so to speak, food ready to be eaten and devoured and enjoyed, with all the hard work done. But I think I must ask you to come with me into the kitchen a little bit this morning to ask what the raw materials are in front of us. Is it chicken or beef or what that we're looking at? Because we can't present ourselves with simple and neat answers on these first four verses of 1 Timothy 2 until we know precisely what this material is all about. What is it about? Well, if you look up the commentaries, many of them say that chapter 2 is about church order. One little commentary that is quite a useful one, I have found, has as a heading for 1 Timothy 2, church order, the conduct of divine service. Now, that's a very simple, straightforward title, isn't it? That tells me that in this chapter, I'm going to discover how to conduct divine service in the Church of God today. So we take it and we read it, as James Beckham did just now, and we find that we don't get any instructions really of that kind at all. Well, we get some, because this is one of the earliest manuals of church order. Indeed, it is the earliest manual of church order that we have. But I think we have to say that from this chapter and from 1 Corinthians, that all Paul has to say about leading divine worship, or whatever you like to call it, in the assembly, in the congregation. All he has to say about that could be put on a postage stamp. Indeed, you could summarize what he has to say about church order in 1 Corinthians by the two words decency and order, and you could summarize what he has to say about public prayer in this chapter in two sentences, which we have in front of us, verses 1 and 2. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't learn anything from the Apostle Paul about church order. I think we can guess quite a lot from the first principles that he laid down. If the great apostle had been in London this week, I would have been very careful not to take him to General Synod on the one hand, and I would be very careful not to take him to any cathedral services this morning. Because I think I'm right in saying that from what we know from his teaching about church order, both were likely to offend him. One wag has said, I don't think it's really a very good example of biblical exposition, but one wag has said that in verse 9, with regard to church order, the great apostle is at pains to see that women do not come heavily adorned in gold and pearls and costly attire. Well, he may have succeeded in that or not in the first century, I can't tell you. But, of course, if he went to a cathedral service in London today, he would find not men attired like women attired like that, but men. And I don't know what he'd have had to say, and I'm not going to be bothered to ask him. Now, let's be much clearer, then, than we can be about those sort of things, and say, what does he want to do when we meet together? And the answer is that he wants us to pray for those in authority, a sentence that has come down into the Book of Common Prayer and the order for the prayer for the church militant, which I'm going to read in a moment, when we get back to our own prayers. But apart from this, there is really very little else in this early part of the chapter about church order. Later on in the book, we shall find that he has something to say about the type of men who should be chosen to be in charge of congregations, and we shall see a little bit about what he has to say on social concerns, the widow, for example. That we'll come to later on. But when we ask ourselves as we sit in the kitchen, what is this material in front of us in verse 2, if you were listening to it read, what is the paragraph about? I don't think you would have really felt that the main thrust of it was about church order. In fact, the main thrust of it is best seen if we pick out a clue, which is this little phrase, all men. I'll try to explain how this fits in a minute. You'll see that little phrase, all men, in verse 1, do you, at the end of verse 1. Intercessions are to be made for all men. Then in verse 2, he says, intercessions are to be made for kings and all in authority. Again, the emphasis on all. Then in verse 4, he says that God desires all men to be saved. And then in verse 6, he says that Christ died for all men. And then verse 7, it's not quite so obvious, but the implication is plain. He was sent as an apostle to the Gentiles because the gospel was not for Jew only, but for all nations, all men. So that in this remarkable paragraph that we're going to study this morning and next Sunday morning, we get very clearly and cogently, in just 7 verses, a theological basis in miniature for the missionary outreach of the Christian church. That is very strange, I think, that it comes here in this form. And I want to try to answer why I think it comes in this form. First of all, it is clear, I think, that there were exclusive tendencies in the church at Ephesus. That is not very unlikely. All the heretical cults in Ephesus and in Asia Minor, all the mystery religions that surrounded the people on every street corner, inviting them to be initiated, all those groups, religious groups, were by definition exclusive and for an elite. In other words, all religion in Paul's day, all heathen pagan religion, was elitish, just rather like Mensa, or the Athenaeum, or the Oxford College High Table. Membership of those societies is very jealously guarded. So membership of all the mystic cults and all the pagan religions of Paul's day was very, very closely guarded. You were let in and the door was shut behind you, and you were taught to rejoice in your privileges, which nobody else could enjoy. Now, that is a very natural human tendency. It's the tendency that C.S. Lewis calls belonging to the inner ring. We all like to belong to an exclusive club. We like to sport an MCC tie because we know that anybody else putting down for membership of the MCC, even if they are only 2 years old at the moment, are not likely to get in until they're 50. And it makes us feel rather proud that we are members of something that other people can't join. And this tendency of exclusivism has come down in the Christian church. And many of you will have had dealings with it, for example, with the exclusive brethren. You have to do a very careful field study to meet the exclusive brethren. If you live in Islington, you will know that the northern part of Upper Street, if you turn off left, there's a little hole in the wall. And in this little hole in the wall is a door which says, if the Lord is willing, the Lord's word will be preached on the Lord's day, and that's all. It's not a very appealing notice, and there's not a great welcome. And into that door, some Christian people will hurry twice a week, once in the midweek and once on the Lord's day. And if you were to follow them, you wouldn't get a great welcome, because they are called and call themselves. Well, they call themselves by different names, exclusive brethren. That is, they have put a palisade around themselves as the little flock of God. Now, that's a very natural tendency, because in a pagan and heathen world, we feel we have to get together and be protected in whatever way we can, and that was happening in Ephesus. But of course, such an exclusiveness is not likely to appeal to the great apostle Paul, if you, by your Bible reading, have got to know him. I mean, look back to chapter 1. Paul gloried as a Jew in the law of God, and he had come to see that the law of God was something that everybody needed. Look at verse 9. The law is laid down for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for the murderers of fathers, murderers of mothers, for manslayers, for immoral persons, sodomites, kidnappers, liars, perjurers, and so on. Pretty plain speaking, isn't it? See, now Paul thinks that you'll find people like that everywhere, in every society, and they need to hear the law of God. We can be quite sure that the Apostle Paul wanted all men to know God's law. In other words, what God likes and what God dislikes. But if you look at verse 12 onwards in chapter 1, and you'll remember this marvelous paragraph, if you were with us on that Sunday morning a few weeks ago, he talks here about the glorious gospel that God has given to him, and the glorious gospel that changed his life. And he summarizes what he has to say about that glorious gospel by saying in verse 15, "The saying is sure and worthy of full acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners." You see, do you see the universal note? He came into the world. So we know very well that Paul is somebody who, having been given this enlightenment, having been brought into the knowledge of God through Jesus Christ, is anxious that everybody should have that same privilege. This gospel was for spreading. It was not for preserving merely, but for preaching. Now, the tension, of course, between preserving and preaching is a tension that goes all the way through life, and especially if you've got something that is threatened. We face this tension, if I may use an analogy, with this old building of St. Helen's Church. Now, there are a great many forces, and perfectly legitimate forces, determined to preserve this building. There are those amongst them, including members of our own diocesan committee, who would like to preserve it precisely as it is for all time. But there is, of course, another side to this question. It has got to be used. It has got to be the headquarters of a growing company of Christians who come here every hour of the week from breakfast to late at night, who need to be able to wash their hands and cook meals and meet without drafts and excessive discomfort. So there's a natural, isn't there, tension between keeping this building as a museum and making it the headquarters of a modern expansionary missionary movement. We have got to insist, haven't we, as Christians, that you cannot preserve a building like this by putting it in mothballs. I think I told you the time when I stood in Hitchin bus station with Phil Jensen, that very articulate and intelligent minister from Sydney. And we were looking at the glorious view of Hitchin Parish Church, which is one of the great parish churches of that part of the world. And Phil, who's so much more observant than I am, having looked at it for about 4 minutes in silence, said, "The only thing that is wrong with that building is that there is nothing built on it of the 20th century. He said, "I see building there of the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, but nothing of the 20th. Now, that was a very intelligent comment, wasn't it? What he is saying is that people in the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries have used that building. All of them have used up-to-date methods to make it more practical. But we have got to a stage where in the 20th century, we are not allowed to touch these things, which means in the end, of course, that those buildings will die. Now, Paul is up against the same tension here. What he is saying is, however beautiful the gospel may be, you cannot put it in a strong room, lock it up, put a guard outside and say, we're never going to lose this gospel. He says, if you do that, if you become an exclusive company of people trying to maintain your cause, your faithfulness and your gospel, in the end you will be destroyed. The gospel is not preserved by apologetics so much as by evangelism. A very, very important truth. Apologetics are important, but evangelism is more important. So that's what he's talking about in verses 1 to 7. He wants this gospel to go everywhere because that is what it is for. Now then, let's look at verses 1 and 2 and see where this instruction about public prayer fits into this great heartfelt desire for evangelism. Let me read these two verses. First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all men, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life, godly and respectful in every way. Now, I don't think that was intended to be a dry, stereotyped sentence, such as you might get in an order book, point 1, point 2, point 3. I think that comes straight from the heart of this evangelistically minded apostle. And to give you something of his heartbeat, will you keep a finger there and turn back to Ephesians chapter 6, verse 18. Here he is again talking about prayer. Prayer as a part of our active service for God. Now verse 18. This is so typical of Paul. Pray at all times in the Spirit with all prayer and supplication. To that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all saints. Did you notice it? What a heart he has. He's a man who speaks, doesn't he, in superlatives, really. He says, pray at all times, not just on Sunday morning, with all prayer and supplication. Keep alert with all perseverance, making supplications for all saints. Notice the alls. That's very characteristic of him. He wants all the Christians to pray all the time for all the world. Now come back to 1 Timothy chapter 2, and you've got the same man speaking. I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions. You see, those words don't mean something different. We're not to say each of those refers to something that is distinctive. He's just piling up words. He's saying, I want you to pray with all your heart for all men and for those in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life. Now let me stop at this point again. We can take so much for granted. For 1,000 years in this country, we have had authorities who are well aware of the Christian faith. Indeed, there can never have been a time in our island history when there are no Christians in authority, either on the throne or in parliament or in the local courts as magistrates. Paul is writing, verse 1, against a background when all the authorities were pagan, when all the religious authorities of Jewry were against the Christian church, when every magistrate was untrustworthy with regard to Christianity, and when the whole state of society was unbelievably impure and dissolute. Now, you see, when everybody's against you, you tend, don't you, to retreat into a lager mentality of defensiveness. All that you can say in such situations, if you were living in Ephesus, was lock up your daughters, because it isn't safe to go abroad in the streets. But you see, when I open this letter and I read what he has to say to the pastors of that day, pastors of very small congregations, and to the little church at Ephesus, he says, I want you to pray for them all. Some jaws must have dropped, mustn't they, in the congregation at Ephesus? But pray for them? Why, a friend of mine was up before the magistrate only last week, and the man was totally untrustworthy and was bribed, actually. You can't trust these men. You want us to pray for them. Now, Paul wants us to pray for them because of a very, very serious biblical doctrine. It's the only other cross-reference I have this morning, and I want every young Christian here to get this doctrine absolutely plain. It's in Romans chapter 13, verse 1, page 152. Now, it's easy to sneer at this doctrine, to say it's a matter of bourgeois mentality and so on, but this is undoubtedly the biblical viewpoint, that God is not God over the church alone, but he's God over all the world. And he's made arrangements to see that this world and our society doesn't collapse from corruption. So, verse 1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, he who resists the authority resists what God has appointed. I won't go on reading because it's rather long, except to ask you to look what letter it is, the letter to the Romans, and to imagine what the Roman authorities were like when it came to Christianity. See, very remarkable, isn't it? The little Ephesian church is told to pray for those in authority. Now, what were the things they're told to pray for? Well, you could guess this. If I told you to shut your Bible and to take a piece of paper and to spend 5 minutes putting down three things that the Christians at Ephesus would be told to pray for, I think most of you would get 2 out of 3, if not 3 out of 3. They're obvious. But look at them. First, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life. First, we're to pray for peace and quiet. The modern phrase for that in politics is law and order. And we're to pray that the authorities will keep the peace. That's why I asked James to read that classic story of the riot in Ephesus, to which this letter went. When for 2 hours the crowd behaved like a crowd in a football stadium, quite out of control, because the worship of their goddess was threatened. Though you notice that Luke, as a very careful writer, says that it wasn't really the worship that was threatened, it was their livelihood that was threatened. Luke is quite clear what a lot of humbug there was in that riot. And we have an example in Acts 19 of a remarkably sane and sensible town clerk, the patron saint of all town clerks ever since, who was able to go into a situation where the friends of Paul wouldn't let him go because they thought he'd be lynched by the mob, and quieten them down and tell them the courts are open. A very, very important sentence. Now you see, without the town clerk in Ephesus and without the town clerk anywhere else, without the magistrate, without law and order, people will take the law into their own hands. And we've seen enough of that even in our own quiet country to realize how dangerous it is. What's the second thing he prays for? He prays that these people may be in control, that we may be able to live godly lives. Godly, beginning end of verse 2. That word means with a reverence for true religion. In other words, he prays that the authorities may make it possible for God-fearers to have religious freedom. That's what Eastern Europe prays for in its churches this morning. That's what Russian Christians pray for in private and in public every week. They pray that the authorities may allow Christians to go about their business, especially on the Lord's Day when they meet together. It's a very natural thing to pray for, isn't it? A very proper thing to pray for. What is the third thing? Godly and respectful, a rather weak translation there. It means grave and honest and refers to a serious concern for private and public decency. That public and private life may not be poisoned by the work and influence of evil men. Now, those are the three things. Just put those in your mind for a moment, will you? Because they're very, very straightforward and absolutely up to date. Paul says we're to pray for the authorities, our own authorities, that they may keep the peace, that they may enable godliness to be freely flourish in the sense of public meeting and so on. They can't obviously make us godly, but they can give us freedom to exercise our rights as godly people. And thirdly, to see that our society is marked by respectfulness, gravity and honesty, and a serious concern for morality. Now he says, this is good and acceptable in the sight of God. And if it's good and acceptable in the sight of God, it should be good and acceptable in our sight too. And then comes the rather curious change of note. Notice, having said this, having asked them in their public prayers as an assembly, as a congregation, to pray for those in authority who are, of course, pagans, but to pray that God will control them, that they may do their proper work and duty, he says, this is good in the sight of God, who desires all men to be saved. Now, that is such a strange change that a few commentators have argued that the word saved there ought to have its ordinary political and physical meaning. In other words, it's good in God's sight that all people should be protected. But you can see from straight away that that interpretation is an impossible one, because he adds a phrase to interpret what it means to be saved in verse 4. He desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. So you see, what Paul is saying is he begins by telling them what they're to do when they meet together in their public praying for the authorities. But you see, this man who is teaching us what to do in church is not a man who is interested in the pastor on the Lord's Day morning doing everything exactly in the right order. He's not interested in that kind of detail. He's a gospel man. And even when talking about praying for those in authority, he's got to see it against the background of his great missionary concern. So his prayer is that the authorities will do their job, which make it easier for us to do our job. Clearly, it is easier for us to evangelize if there is law and order. It is easier for us to evangelize if the freedom of God-fearing men to meet is protected by the government. It is easier for us to evangelize if moral decency and seriousness is supported by the law and not destroyed by it. So you see what the horizons of the apostle are. The horizons of the apostle, though they take in the local authority, never stop there. It would be impossible for Paul to have written the recent Church of England report, Faith in the City. Impossible, because the horizons of that report, which are perfectly proper as far as they go, stop with the regeneration of the inner city in terms of social justice. That is a perfectly proper Christian concern. But Paul could never write about that without going through those horizons to greater horizons. We want social justice in the inner city, he would have said, but we want it as a background to universal salvation. We want everybody in the inner city to hear the gospel. And of that, the church report is quite silent. So it is very, very interesting to see that when he starts to talk about these very practical matters of how our society holds together and what we're to pray for, that he can't stop at this point of peace and godliness and serious moral standards. What he wants is that everybody should be saved from the wrath to come and know the truth of our Lord Jesus Christ. And he gives three amazing reasons why he wants that. The unity of God, verse 5. The atonement of Christ, verse 6. The missionary calling of the church, verse 7. But those reasons are so great and need such a lot of investigation and interpretation that we'll have to look at those next Sunday morning. Let's conclude then by saying this. We must do what we are told here to pray seriously for these things. And as I studied this in the last day or two, it seemed to me that this part of our public worship service here at St. Helens was inadequate. We do pray for those in authority, but it never lasts more than about a minute or two. Indeed, you go to many churches where you won't find them praying at all for it, so it's better to use a minute than nothing. But it seemed to me that we ought to make an effort in the next weeks and months to make our prayers for those in authority more full of meaning. And we ought to pray not only for authorities in this country, but for authorities in other countries where Christians are being oppressed and by the secular arm. We ought to pray for that. And we ought to pray for it not because we are bourgeois and middle class and want just an orderly society. We're sometimes accused of that, and the pastoral epistles have been accused of that. But because we honestly and sincerely desire ourselves, verse 4, that everybody should be saved. If that is your desire, then you should take great care to pray for verses 1 and 2. So let me ask you then to give that your attention in your own daily prayers, because you are a person who wants everybody to come to the knowledge of the truth.